All right. Good morning. Welcome to another episode of Dots of Thoughts, where I just come up with ideas inspired by maybe things that I've been thinking about, reflecting on, or a book that I've read, or maybe an encounter I've made. And speaking of which, I've been spending time with the work of a ballet dancer who is based here in Berlin, but she was born in Bolivia, and she has been traveling and, of course, doing that thing that we all do, which is crossing borders. And her name is Diana Mura. She likes to call herself a freelance ballet dancer. And, of course, we're going to go into what that means. So today we are going to be having a conversation about ballet dancing, about dancing in general, about dancing and the body. And fortunately, she is here with me at the studio. So this is not me having a monologue. Diana, it's really nice to be doing this with you.
Yes, it's a pleasure for me to meet you again. I have been looking forward for this for a long time. And it's really nice to share this with you.
Yes, it's really, and I've been looking forward to it as well. The first time you came to the studio was last year.
Yeah.
And I remember that we spent like about 2 to 3 hours talking.
Yeah.
And what stood out for me was this whole idea of you calling yourself a freelance ballet dancer.
Mm-hmm.
But then eventually I realized that it was a function of how you've come to understand the importance or the role of dance in making your own agency.
Mm-hmm.
So before we go into that, let's give the listeners the benefit of, you know, you talking about who you are and mm-hmm. how you see yourself in relation to what you do.
Okay, well, I'm a ballet dancer, and I decided to be a ballet dancer when I was 6 years old, when I saw Swan Lake. I mean, it was a decision I took when I was a child, and I pushed my mother to get me in ballet classes. And eventually, with years, I managed to finish my education in the National Ballet School there. As in Bolivia, there is not an industry developed surrounding dance, but this doesn't mean that Bolivia has no dance in the culture. I saw myself in the dilemma of getting a real job or something that pays the rent. And my mother was telling me, if you want to work as a dancer, you know that you cannot stay here. And if you want to work as a graphic designer, because I studied graphic design, then at least you have to have a certain amount of income so you can start your own life here. And so I decided to move to Europe. I moved to France first, and I tried to make a career there. And of course, there are cultural differences, artistic differences that you have to adapt to, that you need time to understand how the industry worked. And this is where I had problems understanding, because I now realize, now as in today, that my call for dance was not just ballet. My call for dance comes from my culture and from the lifestyle that we have there. For us, to party is to dance. When you have a birthday, even when there is death, we dance. We dance to honor death. The way industries have developed art is completely different, of course, because there is a whole political, economical context that made us different from what I see here. Eventually, I managed to dance professionally in Europe, and it made me really unhappy, extremely unhappy.
Wow. Okay. So what I'm seeing here, and this is also something I picked up from our conversation the last time you were in mm-hmm. the studio, is that it was when you crossed the borders to Europe that, mm-hmm. and then you found yourself in this context where dance is highly formalized. Mm-hmm. And then it started to remove something of the spirit of it in relation to, you know, how dance is so important in the Bolivian culture.
Mm-hmm.
And you've talked about dance in relation to death even. Mm-hmm. And there's a culture, there is a ritual that is called dance of death or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I remember we talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
So Before we talk about why this whole thing got you unhappy, you know, doing dance in Europe, maybe we should sort of like give a context to that dance of death. What is it about?
It's called Tata Danzanti, and it's a character in the life of communities, Aymara and Quechua communities. You are not just an individual. Of course, you have a role in the community. And when you betray your community, and when you become selfish, or the community decides that you're not actively part of it, or you did something wrong, then you must redeem yourself. And of course, this Tata Danzanti, it's a mask. It's a big green mask that they put to you, and you have to dance until you die. Now, there are many theories and there are many stories about it, because colonization has destroyed our culture, and now syncretism has made the thing evolve in different ways. Mm-hmm. But some say that the community used this as punishment for people who were not responsible within their community. So yes, you would be forced to carry this huge mask and dance until you die. Some other people say that it was also a way of sacrificing yourself in order for agriculture, for rain, or because it is really, until today, we offer a lot of things to the Pachamama. Pachamama is Mother Earth. And I do this now more often. Mm-hmm. You give presents to Mother Earth, because Mother Earth is the one who gives us everything. Everything that is material, she gives us. So we cannot just take. Mm-hmm. We have to give back to her.
That's very interesting. That's really very interesting. You know, the whole notion of Mother Earth and giving back, and also materiality. What else I find very interesting about the ritual of dance of death is, you know, the relationship between dance and body, but also in giving back to the community, or in appeasing the community. So it's very much attached to a communal way of being, or honoring the community.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I know that, or rather I've read somewhere that in the cosmovision of the Bolivian culture, that death is not seen as a demise.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing. So yeah, it's not a finality as one would think of it, you know, in many other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this dance of death is not necessarily tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Let's come back to what you were saying about practicing dance in France made you so unhappy.
I think it was mostly the contrast of what I have lived in Bolivia, because in Bolivia, I grew up as a really shy kid. I was super shy in school, in kindergarten. I was bullied and I didn't have many friends. And the teachers were saying that I had problems. Only dance made me feel like I was free, that I could express myself. And I didn't like words. I didn't like to speak. I only liked to dance. And with ballet, I found like a scientific way, a really mathematical way of expressing myself. Because there are stages that mathematically you discover your body, and you discover that you can build it in a really healthy way. But this has to do with the education I had there and with some teachers that I had there. And when I went to France, I was so disappointed, because for them it's like, you don't need to work that hard. You just need to be born with the typical ballet body. And if you are not born with this, if you don't have the genetics that gave you this flexibility, that gave you this aesthetics, then you're not made to dance. It's not your duty to dance. What was really sad for me was not just that, because with the proportions that are desired to be accepted into ballet schools in Europe, I would have never been a dancer. Never I would have been accepted here in Europe. If I was a child and I would have auditioned for ballet schools, I would not even physically be accepted. So not even considered. And job-wise, this has affected me, because to look for jobs, they always look superficially at what you are,
I read your blog, mm-hmm. and you also talked about this. I think it's in the writing, Why You Choreograph.
Mm-hmm.
Why I Choreograph. This is how it's called. You made a reference to this idea of your body not being the archetypal body for dancing in Europe, and how you are able to now work on your body
mm-hmm.
for it to now be an instrument for your expression as a dancer. I find it very interesting, and I was watching this clip of yours on your website, a video mm-hmm. called Dying Swan. Mm-hmm. Let's play it. So that sound that we hear underneath the music,
mm-hmm.
that's actually your toes.
Point shoes, yeah.
Your point shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was watching this video at first, I was like, she's been standing like this for like over a minute to 2 minutes. Standing that way. And I know I probably don't know much about ballet, but that's so incredible. So what I see here is that you talk about this whole idea of pain on one side, yeah, and pain and stress and the fact that your body is not the typical dancing body. But then you've also managed to make it something that is very resilient
mm-hmm.
and elastic. And but all of that also graceful. So can we talk about, give us a sense of the process. How did you get to this point? And secondly, how does that translate into how you carry yourself today as a person?
Well, I always go back to when I was in the National Ballet School, because not being born with this European body has made me to look for solutions. But in ballet school, I had this teacher. And for me, he was not just a teacher. He was a ballet master. And what I loved about him is that he believed and he, with proper information also about the Soviet era of Russian dance, Russian ballet. He believed that with work, through scientific work, precise work, you could manage to elongate your body into this aesthetics that now Europe believes you just have to be born with it. If you are not born with it, then you don't dance. But my teacher believed that every human body, through work, you can achieve a certain line, not the same, but you can achieve a certain aesthetic if you focus on strength, if you focus on other things but the superficiality of the aesthetics. And I got to experience this with him because I had thick thighs. I have the body of my indigenous descendant mother and grandmothers who worked the land. So we have wide hips, we have curves, and I was developing this. And ballet wants you not to develop this. Every woman should be a woman. When you get, ballerinas don't even get their periods. When time comes, they don't. Some ballerinas get their periods at 20 years old. But I was developing my body like a normal woman and like a normal adolescent. So I had to work on that. And I was lucky to be able to experience this in Bolivia, because in Europe, I would have been kicked out of the ballet school. So I worked through this, and my teacher believed strongly that you don't need to starve yourself to be skinny, that you get this through work. So I actually started to experience and discover this, but this is a really mental exercise. It's not just that you have to stop eating and then you will look pretty. No, you discover beauty only through analyzing yourself and looking within yourself. So I had the idea that I would have more of this information by going to Europe, because Europe has developed ballet so much. Mm-hmm. And then when I got there, everybody was talking to me about diets, about there was this shock. And I refused to believe whenever someone was telling me, the first year in France, I got 12 kilos plus. I gained 12 kilos because I was not training as hard as I was dancing in Bolivia. So I had to figure out things by my own. And I knew that if I would get the right training, I would go back to this shape. And I refused to listen to other people's advice. And what were those advice? Were like, one, just to stop eating. And the other one was accept your body the way it is. None of these advice helped me, because my body, I know my body. I know what I'm capable to do with my body. And I was not this, overweight ballerina. And people were telling me, no, you're beautiful like this, you're beautiful like this. I knew that I was not at my full potential, because I have had experienced it already in school. And people were not understanding me in this side. And in the other side, I had the other extreme telling me, yeah, you're fat, stop eating. And I will put you in pink and in white tights every day, so you look at yourself in the mirror and you hate yourself and you hate your body. And this way you will lose weight. And none of these things, accepting myself the way it was, nor being on a diet,
yeah,
it was not the solution for me. So I spent the first year, it was depression and conflicts with this culture that I was not understanding. Mm-hmm. And actually only when I started to audition and to work, of course, it got better through time. Mm-hmm. And luckily, I always look for solutions. So I always look for people who appreciate work. And this goes beyond nationality or culture. And luckily, I met also a lot of Russian dancers. And what I love about this Russian culture of ballet, that they have this generosity to give you advice when they see that you want and then you like to work hard, but with the brain, they just tell you, no, you're doing this wrong. Maybe you should try this. And with this aggressivity, you know. And I was more used to that. And I took those advices. And until now, they helped me. They helped me a lot. So in the end, I discovered within this search of finding out what the algorithms of the body are, me and my friend, a dear friend who lives now in Frankfurt, we discovered a ballet master that he wrote this algorithm. Because, yes, there is a way of working your body, and you don't have to be born with it. And he has the algorithm written, and he is now sharing his method. And with this method, now I train myself and I keep creating, and I have stopped looking for answers. I have the answer now, and it's like really working with physics, working with algorithms, but of the body. So it's a never-ending work that you can always perfect, and it has nothing to do with the superficiality of, oh, making diets, or just not doing anything and accept your body the way it is. It's like a search for becoming light. Actually, for me, it's like this you're searching for a certain amount of elevation and defying gravity. But it is possible. Otherwise, it doesn't hurt for me to be, like you said, 2 minutes in the pointe shoes. Mm-hmm. Doesn't hurt at all.
And is that like normal, like to go that long in pointe shoes, like the way I've seen in your video, or is that some superhuman stuff?
I think every human can do it with the right work, but it's really hard work and it takes a lot of time.
Okay, guys, I think, you know, if you're listening to this, I think you should check out Diana's website. It's, I think, dianamora.com. Mm-hmm. You should check it out. You check out the video I'm talking about. And she's saying now every human can do this. We know it's not true. We know, I can't stand in pointe shoes for like 2 minutes. I can't. It's completely. So she's giving this really nice and generous answer to this. Every human can do it. But I can imagine that, you know, somehow it has translated and infiltrated your way of being, your disposition as a person. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at your life now, especially with being in Europe and still traveling here and being in this context of being a migrant, how has this kind of appreciation of work and also being so involved and engaged with your body, how does that translate into who you've become?
I think it was really important to me that after all this time that I stopped being true to myself and to adapt myself so much to the Western ballet mentality and lifestyle, that I decided I'm not going to be a part of it anymore because it's really damaging. It's damaging because I have noticed that ballet dancers, professionals, they keep a lifestyle that is isolated from the real world. And I had such a different education, ballet education, that I cannot avoid to be a part of the world. I always loved music. I love it. I love to speak with other humans. And when this art form is so elitist here in Europe, you spend your whole year, I mean, you're telling me that you are not capable of putting yourself in your pointe shoes.
No, I'm not.
In your pointe.
No.
With training, you would be able to. But this training implies a lot of time, years. But at the same time, here in Europe, this training has become so isolated and also superficial, like I said, that most of ballet dancers spend their lives in a ballet context. So they lose complete perception of reality because you only see other dancers and life becomes about only ballet, not even dance. So this hurt me so much because it becomes your life, it becomes your work. And the moment you start earning money and you realize it makes you so unhappy and so many people within the industry make you so unhappy, then you are just hurting yourself by living like them. And I know that they know that this is true, but it's difficult to step away from this because it's really like an elite and it's a bubble. But I decided not to hurt myself anymore in this way. Money-wise, to mix money with personal or anything. Dance is part of me, whatever I will do. And it will be part of me until I die.
So is that a reason why you started like taking a path where one can see you as a freelance ballet dancer?
Yeah.
But also the fact that you talk about that you are dancing for humans, that you want to break away from that esoteric confine of the ballet world and the way it has been formalized for the selected few, which is mainly the bourgeoisie, the middle and the upper middle class, that you think you can do this in a much more open way. And is that also the reason why your website is full of you stretching practically everywhere?
Yes. Actually, I feel like also in my situation, I cannot personally taking care of my own mental health. I cannot be part of this elite because I never felt like I could could be free in there. Well, this has a lot to do with this video that you liked, The Souls for Sale.
Yeah.
Because ever since I'm a child, I am really creative. And this has also damaged me because I like to choreograph. I like to create things. And being a dancer in Europe, professional dancer, it means that you're only a dancer. It means that you only obey to what the choreographer said, because this is how the industry was developed, of course. Mm-hmm. Choreographer is choreographer, dancer is dancer. You're not a choreographer if you're a dancer. Mm-hmm. And you're not a human being if you're a dancer. You're some extraordinary person that was blessed by the gods, or I don't know. Mm-hmm. But to me, this is not normal.
And there's also that a lot of that objectification. And you talked about that a lot. But before we even go into that, because this is something you wrote about in a very specific way, and I felt when I was reading your blog, Why I Choreograph, that you wanted people to read not only what you're saying, but to hear in a very specific voice, your own voice. And what I find interesting is that you even made reference such as, well, if I am really objectified sexually, then I know even how to use that. Yeah. But when I'm in the room, I'm not even seen as a woman or a person. I am seen as an object that is supposed to perform. Mm-hmm. But I'm a human being. I am a woman. I am all of that. So in a way, you are talking about a specific kind of objectification that is related to who you are as a person is unique. It is not the one that is caught up in the whole big conversation about objectification of the body, of a woman's body, and the internet. But it's one that sort of like finds an intersection between you being a dancer and people not taking that serious as something that is a human thing, mm-hmm. but also being a woman and you people not taking that serious as as womanhood. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's sort of like crossing each other and somewhat canceling out each other in a way. It directly leads into this last post that you made on social media. Mm-hmm. I think, was that your first post of the year or was it the last one of last year?
The first post of the year.
Okay. And then I have it here, which you've developed into a text. So maybe you should read it out.
Mm-hmm. All I have to offer comes from my body, but not in the way you might think. I have no possessions. My whole life can fit in a suitcase. As precarity has led me to deprive myself from the need of buying property, I have found myself often in the lonely conclusion that I have nothing to offer more than what my body can provide. All the thoughts that came to my mind were inside my body. All the decisions I took them while being in this body. When I dance, my brain is not in a box at home separated from my body. When I read, I do it with this brain, these eyes, these hands. When I speak, I do it with this voice that comes out of my throat. My body is my territory. And as a person of color, this has brought me a lot of confusion throughout the years of homelessness and hustling. Trying to separate my heart from my brain has caused me more damage than good. As my 10th year living here in Europe starts, I have no other conclusion than my body is my territory. My body is my home. So whenever I buy myself a nice pair of shoes, I do it with the love I have for my home. Whenever I train my ballet technique, I train to build a strong, healthy home. Whenever I read and research about the things that make me passionate, I do it so my home will not fall apart when someone judges it without knowing what it has been through. I will never apologize for wanting to find beauty within me because whiteness wants me to remain poor and ugly. It wants me to see myself only as a labor resource. I am much more than that. This is why some might see me as superficial. But I have been too self-destructive in my past. This has hurt people around me. But life has brought my close friends closer. My love for my family became more humble and unconditional, and my own relationship grew stronger. This has been only possible by working on taking care of my home, my body, myself, getting rid of Christian guilt, focusing on my sacred feminine, starting to acknowledge that yes, we all create life with our bodies, and our bodies are the extensions of Mother Earth. As people of color, we must love ourselves in order to create a better future. And when I talk about love, I don't mean in the commercial movie romantic way. I mean it in the kind of tough love, both rational and emotional, both harsh and kind, both disciplined and compassionate, with no Christian guilt, with no white savior complex, empathy, with no pity, and mostly with the wish that each human finds liberation within this self-love and shares this with their loved ones. Because there is no self-love without love towards our people. We must make our home stronger so we can find the battles that we choose to fight. You cannot find self-love without love for others, and vice versa. Time is not linear, so there is no order for figuring things out in life.
Listening to this, it reads like a manifesto. let me call it a manifesto because she's Bolivian. You know, when you say manifesto, this is it feels like, you know, from this place, you know, this is how people talk, like a manifesto. So, it's so powerful. In this time, we were asking questions about how do we move forward? How do we break away from the clutches of whiteness and white privilege and racism and all of that without having to respond to it? Mm-hmm. Because this is the big question today. No one says, I don't want to deal with white people or whiteness. No one says that. We all want to share this world together. Mm-hmm. It's just that no one wants to continue to respond to whiteness. Mm-hmm. So it feels to me like in this time when we're asking ourselves, how do we continue to live in a world where all of us can share, but also move beyond having to always respond the kind of mindset, the kind of reality that whiteness has created? Mm-hmm. It feels to me that this is almost like a manifesto on how to go, because you kept going and saying, my body, my body, my body. And I love that a lot. I love the fact that you kept emphasizing on the fact that your body is your home. You know, you are one person who is very conversant with how and how a body can be someone's everything. Mm-hmm. But again, coming from Souls for Sale, this work, and all the way to here. So that work, you did it in 2019, I think. Mm-hmm. And all the way to 2022. Mm-hmm. That's been a journey.
Yeah.
So let's basically listen to excerpts from Souls for Sale again to get a sense. I mean, people listening to this will not see what you're doing there. Again, I encourage you to go to Dinah's website and really see this video. But the sound already says a lot. So let's listen to the music a bit, and then we'll come back to discuss what has happened from 2019 to 2022. All right, so this is the excerpt from the Souls for Sale, and it's a huge like contrast between this and the usual, say for instance, the music or the sound behind Dying Swan, for instance. But again, you spoke about this work specifically as a turning point for you, and something that started, you know, that look into yourself, or even called it, like you said on your writing, one of the writings, you said, if this work makes you uncomfortable, that's really what I want, because this is a purging. So can we speak about that a bit?
Well, in this moment of my life, I had so many frustrations. I had so many bad experiences within my professional ballet life. This doesn't mean that I didn't have good ones. It's not all bad. Of course, the moment you are on stage, you love to be on stage. but everything that surrounded it was so oppressing to me. And despite that, I managed to successfully work as a dancer, but there was always something that was not good enough for me. And I was always not satisfied. When you want to work as a dancer, you go to auditions. So you have a number here in your chest. And people look at you only by your physical attributes, whether you are hireable or not. And only going through after the physical tests, only then you get to have an interview to really show your personality. And my problem is that I hate competition. I hate it. I hate to compete with other people. For me, ballet is only about competing with yourself and finding, figuring out yourself. And auditions have always made me so self-conscious, and it had made me doubt about myself so much, because in these situations, I would dance the worst. In these situations where the spotlight is put only in my worth, is only, like I said, an object with a number, I stop being myself, I feel oppressed, and I dance horribly, like with fear, mostly with fear. And when you dance with fear, it's really ugly to watch. Whoever you are, when you dance with fear, it looks not well. So of course you don't get hired. So I was in this vicious circle of putting myself in situations, auditions, of fear. The whole purpose of auditions is to make you feel fear and to compete with savagery, with others, lying to yourself. But this doesn't mean that I don't like to compete with myself and to push myself, but I had to compete with others. And this ambiance was really horrible to me. And not that, not just that. But in France, I had a really humiliating experience, and I talk about it in the article I wrote. I danced as a dog in France because I auditioned for this Peter Pan production. And they hired me, and I know that they hired me because back in then, I was in this mentality of, I will say yes to everything. In my life, also, I was in a situation where I could not afford to say no to a job, because you have to earn money, you have to pay your rent. So I got this job, and usually they hired someone else to do this part of the dog. The person who was supposed to dance the dog, she was not told that she would dance as a dog until the first day of work.
Seriously?
Yeah, because is a lack of professionalism, and it's a lack of organization.
Oh, it was deliberate? Was it deliberate?
Course,
because they didn't want you to say no.
Yeah, nobody in this industry would want to dance as a dog, because the part implied that you would not actually dance. You would just be in like a dog, a real dog. So they told this to her the first day, and she quit. She tried, and it was too heavy for her, and she quit. So, of course, they knew me because I worked with this company already, and they knew I would always be doing the dirty job. And they told me, can you please do it? And in this moment, I was breaking up with my partner, and I needed the money, so I could not say no. But it was really humiliating. It was the situation that was humiliating, because the choreographer was super kind to me. They understood that it was a humiliating situation. But personally, I was going through personal things that were also humiliating. But I felt in that time that, because I'm really critical of myself too, I felt like I put myself in this situation of dancing as a dog, that it is because I reflect this lack of self-worth or this slavery to others, that others take advantage of this from me. So I was making myself responsible for this. And partially, I was responsible for this, for making this happen to me. And this is why in this video, in Souls for Sale, and plus the auditioning and all of these really dehumanizing things, I I was crying in this part of the video when I said, I'm tired of being the dog. I'm not more the dog anymore. And this was a point in my life where I started to realize that I needed to heal this from me, this slavery within me, these patterns that was making me repeat this self-harm. Because you only allow others to treat you like you respect yourself.
Mm-hmm. And very true.
I was lacking this. Mm-hmm. I needed to respect myself more. How? And of course, to me, it is essential. This is why Marxism, indigenism, my identity became more important. Because now I have these tools to say, okay, now I am sabotaging myself. I'm destroying my body. I'm destroying my mind. And I'm destroying my career too. Because when you don't give value to your work, you destroy your career. But I was still a slave within my mind. And my husband back then, he pushed me to not accept the fact that I was just a number, that I was just a dancer who would just put a number and that was my whole career and that was my destiny. So he decided to shoot this dance video.
It's amazing because it's full of energy. It was also well filmed, you know, with care and diligence, even though it was talking about this purging. But again, there was a lot of life injected into the process from you that made me feel like it is beautiful, even though it made a point of saying this is something that is supposed to be referencing some sort of ugliness.
Mm-hmm.
But it made the point without being ugly in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
So where are you now? Do you feel like, okay, I have arrived, I have, you know, done all the purging well enough?
Mm-hmm.
That it's happened now that I sort of like have a kind of clarity of who I am and what I want to do with myself, my life. Do you think you have the answer?
I don't have an answer. I am just in peace with myself and in peace with the tools that I have. And I know that these will lead to more creation and more opportunities. And it doesn't matter if it leads also to working in theaters from time to time. What is important is, like I said in the text, that from the point where my home is in peace and it's in structure, nobody can break it from outside.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I also picked up that you said there's one German word that you like, which is Heimweh.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a word to express when someone misses home.
Mm-hmm.
And you've carried that word for a long time, say, you mm-hmm. know, for 9 years since you've been traveling. So do you think that you've sort of like resolved it? Do you think you found the home?
I think yes, because I haven't been back to Bolivia ever since I left my country. And I have missed it so much that in some way I have also romanticized it. And when this coup happened in 2019, I realized that a lot of friends of mine back there were not friends. And I realized also that my reality there was also not as perfect as I thought it was. And this doesn't make it... This doesn't mean that that I should not give it the value that it deserves, because for me, my Bolivian culture is essential, but in the way of also anthropologically, that searching for the history and everything. And this actually created distance with some of my friends there. So I don't know how I would feel. I don't know if I would feel home there. Of course, I would feel home with my parents, with my family, because this is, of course, essential. But in the society, there is still a lot of colonization and the mentality. I think that this liberation from me came with the experience of traveling. And it came with the experience also of witnessing in Europe and speaking to Europeans and to getting to know the culture, because not everything is also bad. So I found myself free in many other ways here in Europe that I wouldn't find in Bolivia. As a woman, I know that, for example, here now, I can certainly just speak more openly and be safer, and to use my platforms to express this point of view. In the end, with the projects that I'm writing and thinking about creating and rehearsing elevator pitch and pitch decks that I have been writing and experiencing with, I came to the conclusion that yes, if I happen to feel like a stranger in Bolivia, I will be ready for it too, because my home is my body.
Oh, this is amazing. Well, thank you so much, Diana. This conversation has been great, and I'm happy that we eventually found the time to do it, and also that it is setting the stage for the new year. It's been lovely having you here and doing this with you.
It's been a pleasure.
All right. So that's it for this episode of Dots of Thoughts. Thank you for making it all the way to the end with us. And if you want to comment on what we said, or, you know, maybe add your two cents, you know, leave a comment in the comment section of your most preferred listening platform, or you can even reach out to Diana. You know, her website is dianamora.com.
.com was already taken.
Oh, .com was already taken. Okay, so .de, Diana, D-I-A-N-A, Mora, M-O-R-A. And as for Dots of Thoughts, it's a project under the Nkata podcast. And you can check it all out at nkatapodcast.com. And of course, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the major listening podcast listening platform out there. So thank you, and hopefully hear from you. Bye-bye.
Bye.